This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehis Wuhib in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight...
Political tensions are rising in Zambia, where authorities this week arrested opposition leaders and allegedly beat a radio station owner. The opposition leaders are disputing charges of sedition for protesting an August presidential poll they say was rigged.
That's VOA's Anita Powell reporting from Johannesburg. Details coming up also. The Nobel Peace Prize recipient for this year's is Colombia's president, Juan Manuel Santos. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, Colombia's president, Juan Manuel Santos, is this year's recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize. The announcement was made today in Oslo, Norway. Mr. Santos led lengthy government negotiations to end 50 years of war with the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or FARC. The treaty was signed with FARC leaders last month, but Colombian voters narrowly rejected the agreement in a national referendum 4 days ago. More than 200,000 people died during the civil war. The peace treaty allows rebels to confess and turn in their weapons without facing trial for possible atrocities. The committee did not select FARC leader Rodrigo Londoño, who said the only prize he wanted was peace and justice in Colombia. Political tensions are rising in Zambia, where authorities this week arrested opposition leaders and allegedly beat a radio station owner. The opposition leaders are disputing charges of sedition. They were protesting an August presidential poll they say was rigged. Zambians say they fear these events will destabilize the country. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
Everything happened so fast. From nowhere, I was grabbed in my jeans. Somebody held my shirt and they were, you know, advising each other, let's pull her inside where there's no one. There's too much attention outside here.
That's Lisa Kasomba, owner of Zambia's Komboni Radio. She spoke to VOA from her home where she is on bed rest after Wednesday's confrontation with Lusaka police outside her office.
I screamed for help. They kicked my leg as I fell down. They started dragging me by my hair, trying to pull me in, started kicking me. They started, you know, beating me up. And they were just doing that in my ribs. And this police officer grabbed my bra to the extent that it isn't cut. My breasts were so painful as he pulled me, and I caught his hand and bit him.
Authorities suspended operations at Kasomba Station in April during the tense run-up to an August presidential poll for unspecified allegations of unprofessional conduct. Kasomba had gone to her station on Wednesday after authorities informed her she had permission to reopen. Police have now charged her with assaulting an officer, which she denies, though she says she defended herself. Also this week, police arrested Zambia's top opposition leaders and charged them with sedition over their claims that August presidential poll, won by President Edgar Lungu, was unfair. Opposition leader Hakainde Hichilema and his deputy, Jeffrey Mwamba, were released on bail. Dozens of their supporters were also arrested. In a statement, Hichilema denied the charges, describing them as laughable, utter nonsense, stupid. Analyst Impo Motsamai of the Pretoria-based Institute for Security Studies says this sort of turmoil is new for Zambia, a nation that has a long history of peaceful transfers of power and multi-party democracy.
It's a very important development here in Zambia, and it is worrisome in some circles for the simple reason that it can create an impression that there is kind of a political witch hunting on the part of the president in dealing with somebody who then challenged his legitimacy.
VOA News tried to reach the nation's information minister, but he did not answer repeated calls seeking comment. Chilufya Tayali, founder of the new Movement for Economic Development and Equity, told VOA he doesn't think Zambia is in a crisis yet, but says he is concerned about the implications of recent events.
There is no investor who wants to invest in a country that is not stable, There is no investor who is looking to invest in a country that does not respect human rights. There is no investor that is looking at investing in a country where the opposition are not given that freedom of expression, freedom of movement.
Kasomba says her station will remain closed until she is well enough to collect her confiscated transmitter. She says the scariest thing about her assault was not its suddenness or its brutality. What scared her the most, she said, was that she yelled for help and saw confused faces on the many people around her. She thinks they were asking themselves, who do we call for help when the people who would help are the ones doing this? Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
The UN High Commissioner for Refugees, Filippo Grandi, is calling on richer countries to shoulder more of the burden of caring for the millions of refugees who mainly have sought asylum in poorer countries. Lisa Schlein reports on the outcome of the UNHCR's annual refugee conference in Geneva.
High Commissioner Filippo Grandi says he is hopeful the renewed commitment made by governments attending the conference will translate into concrete actions to help resolve the world's burgeoning refugee and displacement crisis.
The majority of those 65 million that we always talk about are not in the rich world. They are in the poorer countries. And those poor countries need more of the rich world to share their responsibilities.
Grandi says richer countries can help in different ways. For instance, it can give more money to the poor host countries or resettle more refugees. He says refugee crises are accumulating throughout the world. He notes that over the four-day refugee conference, 13,000 new South Sudanese refugees fled into neighboring countries. During the same period, he says 10,000 refugees and migrants were rescued in the Mediterranean Sea, while people in eastern Aleppo remain trapped in their besieged city. Grandi says the European Union's plan for relocating 160,000 Syrian and other refugees has not been implemented. He tells VOA much of this refugee crisis could be resolved if EU member states shared the burden. Instead, he says, Greece has been forced to deal with the lion's share of this problem.
They have 50,000 people that were blocked there when the borders got closed. Through relocation and perhaps resettlement outside Europe, most of that problem would be solved very quickly. And Greece is ready to absorb those that cannot go through these other channels.
Grandi agrees some protracted refugee problems, such as those stemming from Somalia and Afghanistan, are very difficult to resolve. But he says there are numerous situations which are moving or have moved forward. He cites Ivory Coast, Mali, and Myanmar as examples of countries that have more or less stabilized and largely put their refugee problems to rest. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In Libya, Western powers support the UN-backed government of national accord. On the other hand, Arab nations, led by Egypt and Saudi Arabia, are backing General Khalifa Haftar, commander of a Libyan national army. West of Tripoli, there's a different power play going on. Militias are focused on a business-like control of the routes for smuggling weapons, migrants, and jihadis. Then there's an armed group in Zintan who want another member of the Gaddafi family to run Libya. Veteran journalist Murad Taib in Tripoli talks to VOA's David Arnold about the political landscape of the renegades in Libya's west.
We have more unrest and more violence since the arrival of the National Accord government. And consequently, we have more weapon business, more migration business, which is also very active in coastal towns. So the general landscape is not, to my mind, favorable to any political settlement in the near future.
The capital city seems to be surrounded by militias. Are they all in support of the national government of unity?
No, many of them are not. But in Zintan, there are a lot of factions, and many of them, the strong ones, are more or less neutral. I mean, as those who are on the west, near Tunisia and Algeria, their biggest interest is controlling the land and controlling the border with Tunisia and Algeria, where huge business is taking place. Most of the factions west of Tripoli do battle for the land and for the control of the borders because of the importance of the business taking place on the Tunisian-Libyan borders.
What kind of business is going on the Tunisian border?
Everything has been smuggled through the Tunisian-Libyan borders, mainly gasoline, fuel, and consumer goods. And the major southern Tunisian towns like Benghazi, Medinet, Heba, Zarzis, even Jerba and Gabes live on this, what we call illegal business on the borders. But since the collapse of the old regime in Libya, everything else might be smuggled, like weapons and jihadis, which cross the borders to and from Tunisia.
There is one militia, the Zintani militia. Do you know what their political affiliations are?
Some of them are pro-Muslim Brotherhood, some of them are pro-Abdul Hakim Belhaj, and some are pro-Gaddafi. You know that Muammar Gaddafi and family were also popular in the Zintan region, but they still have some popularity in some pockets in Zintan. And in fact, those groups in Zintan are the ones, besides those of Sirte, are the ones supporting Saif al-Islam Gaddafi to go back to power.
Do you think then that the national government of unity in Tripoli will be successful?
I was at the beginning, last year, I was optimistic, but little by little I started doubting that because outside the armed group in Libya, the ordinary Libyan citizens are not happy with going on and are not happy with what the government has been doing. And I think this government lacks self-confidence. They lack the clear-cut strategies for Libya, and they lack real solutions for the economic, military, and political deadlock in Libya.
Far to the east in Libya, General Khalifa Haftar has been quite successful marshaling forces in what he calls the Libyan National Army. What do you suppose the militias near the Tunisian border would do?
I think the influence of Haftar and his troops will not go beyond Benghazi and the oil towns in the east. I think after 3 years of civil war, Haftar did not show that he is able to go beyond those towns in the east. He didn't even reach Sirte, although he said many times that he was able to do it. But practically on the ground, Haftar's troops did not go beyond Benghazi and Briga and the other oil towns.
That was veteran Libyan journalist Murad Tayyib. He spoke to VOA's David Arnold in Washington. This week, Zimbabwe's main opposition party, the Movement for Democratic Change, the DMC, celebrated its 17th anniversary. For nearly two decades, the party has pressured the government of President Robert Mugabe and his ruling ZANU-PF party to democratize. The DMC governs many municipalities throughout the country and served in a government of national unity from 2009 to 2013. Brian Rafatopoulos is a senior fellow at the Center for Humanities Research at the University of the Western Cape in Cape Town, South Africa. Reporter William Eagle asked him about some of the successes and failures of the MDC over the years.
I think the major achievement was to build a massive opposition party out of a conglomeration of social forces and to not only challenge ZANU-PF, but actually beat it in elections, but be denied victory through the violence of the state. So this was a huge achievement for the MDC to have been able to beat the sitting liberation movement as it did, especially in 2008, but arguably also in 2002. This was a huge achievement and one that should not be underestimated.
What have been among, on the other side, its errors? Looking back 17 years, what may have been missed opportunities or things that may have been done differently with perhaps a different outcome?
Well, I think certainly one of the biggest mistakes made was the divisions within the MDC. The divisions in 2005, which led to the first split but particularly the lack of a consensus before the 2008 election, when coming together as two MDCs, they would have gained an even larger victory than they did in that year, and almost certainly would have made it more difficult for the Mugabe regime to steal that election in the way they did. I think that was one of the biggest mistakes, and in fact, two of the biggest mistakes. The other one, of course, is I think once they went into the government of national unity, they didn't spend as much time consolidating their party structures, preparing the electorate in terms of registration and the electoral processes for the 2013 election. And they became somewhat complacent while part of the state and while part of government.
They did, however, help negotiate a new constitution. How important is that today? Some complain that the legislature, the parliament, and the government have not lived up to the spirit of it, that a lot of the new constitution, the old laws on the books now, have not been made to cohere to the new constitution.
No, I think that's true. I think the making of the new constitution was an important event, something that the MDC as well as civic groups were fighting for from 1998-1999. The problem, of course, has been that this ruling party, ZANU-PF, has very selectively aligned the laws with that constitution, and they'll continue to do so. So they have been very weak on constitutionalism historically, the ruling party. So the problem is, yeah, we have this constitution which has a great deal of potential, but ZANU-PF has deliberately, selectively applied alignment of the laws with that constitution because they don't want to put in place laws that will effectively weaken their position.
Who is in charge of making sure that the laws align with the new constitution? Is there any mechanism in place or any bureau or office of the government that is charged with that task?
Well, there's a Ministry of Justice, of course, but there's also Parliament, which is supposed to push for that alignment. And, of course, ZANU-PF has a majority in the Parliament now. But effectively, the presidency, which has been whose central position has been consolidated in the new constitution, the presidency remains in charge of the pace and the manner in which the alignment of laws takes place. And that's why Mugabe's central role as a president remains such an obstacle and an impediment.
What can opposition parties across Africa learn from the example of the MDC, especially those parties battling an entrenched one-party system or even a one-man dictatorship?
Well, what they learn is that elections, certain kinds of elections, have limited feasibility and limited viability. And even if you win those elections, these authoritarian states refuse to give up state power and will find every reason to deny the rightful winners of elections the right to that state power. And that's been a key lesson from Zimbabwe and I think across other parts of the continent.
That was political analyst Brian Raftopoulos of the University of the Western Cape in Cape Town, South Africa. He was speaking with reporter William Eagle. The historic Paris Climate Agreement takes effect on November 4th, now that enough countries have signed on to it. The agreement was adopted last December in Paris at the COP21 meeting. It aims to limit the rise in global temperatures to 1.5 degrees Celsius by reducing carbon emissions. Among those praising the convention is Eliza Northrup of the World Resources Institute. She spoke to VOA's Jody Kapawa about what will happen come November.
The Paris Agreement that was adopted last year is truly a sort of a universal international climate agreement where all parties, all countries, both developed and developing, are signing on to take ambitious climate action, both mitigation as well as adaptation. The agreement also commits to a regular ratcheting up mechanism. So it's a very durable agreement where we hope that this coming back to the table every 5 years to collectively take stock of progress will achieve the temperature goals under the Paris Agreement, the 2 degrees, and get us closer to the 1.5 degrees as well.
Now, this was adopted last December. It's going to take effect on November 4th, less than a year. As international conventions go, this seems to be pretty quick.
This is very, very quick. There hasn't been one that's been quicker for a multilateral agreement of this level of importance. Most take, at minimum, a couple of years. I mean, the UNFCCC, the convention that the Paris Agreement is under, took 2 years. The Kyoto Protocol, sort of the predecessor to the Paris Agreement, took almost 7 years. Other multilateral environmental agreements, such as the Montreal Protocol, still took over a year, even though that also had very widespread support. So this is very unprecedented and very quick.
And what does it mean that it was adopted and signed so quickly?
I think it reflects the broad political commitment. You know, developed and developing countries have joined the agreement, small, large economies. Countries have really shifted the landscape around climate action. It is now seen as a benefit. Parties want to join. They don't want to be left out.
Would you explain a little bit about the attempt to limit the rise in global temperatures? For the average person, we may hear 2 degrees or so Celsius. Doesn't seem like a lot, but is it?
Yes, absolutely. 1.5 degrees will be called an existential threat to low-lying islands as well as coastal regions. So 2 degrees is even warmer than 1.5, which would mean many of these small island developing states really would have to relocate. Coastal regions, internal displacement within countries, changing agricultural patterns globally would cause significant shifts in our economies and our daily lives, even within that sort of 1.5 and 2 degree range. Both of those can be adapted to, but would cause significant impacts to every individual across the world.
How does this treaty really hold governments' feet to the fire to make sure that this is done?
I think through a number of different mechanisms. So the Paris Agreement is one that significantly increases the transparency of national climate action. Under the Paris Agreement, all countries are now required to report regularly on how they're implementing their national climate commitments. They're all required to then go through some sort of form of review, both through experts as well as sort of a multilateral setting. And then there is also a new mechanism and a committee established under the Paris Agreement to help facilitate implementation and promote compliance.
Now, if all goes according to plan, is there any way scientists can speculate, predict, guess when you might start seeing the effects of this convention?
The first big international moment where countries will come back to the table and take stock of their progress so far will be in 2018, all countries coming back to assess progress towards the long-term goals around mitigation in the Paris Agreement. So I think that'll be the first moment where we really start seeing how countries are implementing and the progress that is being made. That moment is also critical because it will provide countries with the information to hopefully go back and review, update and increase, hopefully, the ambition in their NDCs pre-2020. So I think we'll start to see the impact and the effect of this agreement over the next couple of years.
That's Eliza Northrup of the World Resources Institute. She spoke with VOA's Jody Capua.
When news breaks,
and that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. And then tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Pete Hunley, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there.
VOA.
On weekends, tune into Nightline Africa at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our 5-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Celebrate the sounds of Africa today, yesterday, and tomorrow. That's our mission in your show, Music Time in Africa. Hello, I'm your host, Heather Maxwell. Join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC and discover the best Pan-African music in the world. We play it all right here. Only the best on VOA Africa.